Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a soldier for life. The battle I'm fighting has no ending. To struggle is to go the distance. To win is not to care how far one must go.
How you feel?
Fine, sir.
How you feel?
Fine, sir.
How do we get access to this Jackson?
His lawyers say they can get me in posing as a legal investigator.
You were Huey Newton's lawyer.
Yes.
And now Mr. Jackson.
Mr. Jackson was sentenced 1 year to life for a $70 gas station robbery.
We have 2 hours.
Waiting a long time.
We need brothers who can maintain their self-respect in here, have true strength.
Some people are comparing you to Eldridge Cleaver, Richard Wright, Du Bois. How does your fame affect you when you're locked up all day?
Free the Soledad Brothers!
Free the Soledad Brothers!
Do you understand that there cannot be a peaceful revolution?
Okay, gentlemen, we're taking over.
Mr. Jackson, sorry about your brother.
They will live to regret it. I'll see you today. Get him where it hurts.
Starring Gary Dorden from TV CSI.
This is the military, David.
Good evening. Welcome to another edition of George Jackson University Radio. I'm your co-host, Brother Jonathan. I'm joined as well by my co-host, Brother Bomani Shakur. And we have a very interesting, informative show for you this evening. Normally at this time, I will read Black history facts, you know, things that happened this day in Black history throughout the past years. But for technical difficulties, I'm not able to do that right now. So I just like, before we get started, I'd just like to read off a quote I read on this website called Motherland. A brother of mine showed me the quote. They have a Facebook page, I believe. I believe they're connected with the larger organization, African Holocaust Society. But the quote reads, "It is not only how we react to racism as it happens, it is what we are doing when it is not on CNN or trending on social media that matters even more. But if you go to most of these people right now and say, let us work on education, you'll get a blank look. If you say, let us do business and support each other, they will think you're out of your mind. Why are you talking about that for? Nobody shot us today. There was no Katrina last week, Chinese beating on us or stealing everything, or beating on us for stealing right now. Everything is fine, no need for that. So we go back to sleep until another Trayvon Martin incident happens. Then we go and burn something and wait for another Trayvon to happen. And it is this disconnect that keeps us someone's football." So I found that quote to be pretty powerful. It pretty much sums up how reactionary we are. You know, something happens, we get all pumped up. You know, like I was hearing about a Korean store that was shut down. You know, but after, you know, they shut a Korean store down after one of the store owners, like, assaulted the black woman. I mean, I don't have a problem with that, but the bigger issue is, why wait for something like that to happen? Why aren't you on a daily basis building black business in the community and, you know, getting these people out the community, you know, the same communities that there is, we wouldn't be welcome in. You know, why are we always waiting until someone gets shot by the police, then we want to go out and protest or do something? You know, we wait until Hollywood makes a bad movie about us or depicting us negatively. We go and protest instead of, you know, working on a daily basis to make our own films, to build our own studios. So I just thought that was kind of interesting. And like I said, it's something people have been talking about it before I was born, when I read stuff back from the 60s, and it said today that we're still in that reactionary state of mind, you know. So with that said, I'm going to pass the microphone over to my fellow co-host, Brother Bomani Shakur. You online, good brother?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I'm online, Conrad. How you doing, Conrad?
Out of sight.
I'm online, Conrad. I'm going to say Revolutionary Rich Hall, Free Lands Hall, African Liberation at B5 Hodier, Free All the Political Prisoners, Education for Liberation, for the Mind and the Masters of the People, Georgia University. Our main focus is to transform the criminal mentality to a revolutionary mentality. And all we do that through education, educating the minds and the masses of the people who are ignorant to themselves and don't understand that we're at war and our enemy is oppression. Georgia University, we work tirelessly to engage the people, to get involved with the people struggling on the veto YY2. We encourage the people to be adamant participants in their own community and help upbuild the community, to make the community a better society and a better area where they build their minds, body, and soul. The Georgia University is an informative educational platform, and our whole objective is to supply information to the masses of the people so they can make their own conscious decisions. Because one thing we realize is that we cannot make anybody do anything against their own will. People can make all free will, choice, and decisions to be what they choose to be in this life. Right now, this is the age of technology sophistication. Some people call it the age of Aquarius, where everybody is seeking knowledge. Sometimes knowledge is just a trend, but you have people who are serious about certain forms of information, certain knowledge, who are actually contributing to work with the people. By doing things that benefit the needs of the people, like free health clinic, free breakfast programs, mentorship programs, other aspects of things that involve our people. And we know that right now the biggest form of oppression that we're facing is the system known as mass incarceration, the prison industrial slave complex, which is a multiple billionaire corporation that all the capitalists and imperialists invest and engage into to keep our people in modern day slavery right now. Keep people in slavery of mind, body, and soul. We try to bring the most relevant issues to the forefront of people's mind on their radio broadcast. And we had different various shows with various subject lines and timelines regarding the situation, regarding the people from all levels and aspects. On this show tonight, we're going to come from a legal perspective in regards to law. In regard to litigation, in regards to the prison industrial slave, in regard to rebellion. On the show tonight, I would like to welcome our attorney, Michael Dutch. How you doing, Brother Mike?
Fine. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, well. First of all, I would like you to introduce yourself to the people, give the people a little brief background of who you are before we start this off.
Okay, I'm a lawyer, and I'm part of a group of lawyers called the People's Law Office. And we're in Chicago, and we began in 1969. We were representing the Panthers and the Young Lords, and we were the lawyers for Fred Hampton, who your listeners might know was assassinated by the conspiracy between the FBI and the Chicago police. On December 4th, 1969, and we represented his family and the survivors of the attack on the Panther Party. And we do a lot of work around police brutality cases and wrongful convictions. We were involved in the Attica prison rebellion, defense of the Attica prisoners. And we've done a lot of work on representing victims of political repression and those people have been resisting since 1969. So we're almost 50 years into it.
Okay. My next question is, what actually inspires you to do this work in regards to the people?
Well, because it's a struggle against injustice. It's a way that we as lawyers can support people who are involved in liberation struggles, who are victimized by the government and repressed. And this is the long history of this country claiming to be a democracy, but essentially repressing people who are struggling for freedom and equality. And as a result of that, they use the legal system as a way to shut up people and incarcerate people and destroy political movements. And because we've been trained in the law, it is our obligation, we believe, to be assist in those people who are struggling for justice.
True indeed. But I understand. But before you join the People Law Center, you work for the government?
No, I never worked for the government. When I started right out of law school, I was a clerk for a judge. And after a year of that, I joined the People's Law Office. So I've been there since 1970. We never worked for the government or for any institution. We've always been private people's lawyers.
Okay. When you work with a judge, what type of experience did you attain that were beneficial to your experience now as a lawyer for the people?
What experience did I have prior to becoming a lawyer for the people?
Yeah.
Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, I asked you when you work for the judge, what type of experiences can you recall that became beneficial to you later on as a people's lawyer?
Good question. I saw how the judicial system works from the inside, right? From the viewpoint of the judges and the legal process. And I realized from that how unequal and unfair the system was and how it was set up to keep poor people and people of color from getting equal rights. So that really gave me a political perspective on how the justice system works from the inside. So I brought that understanding to my work outside the system, fighting the system.
Okay. Now that's an interesting experience. You were speaking earlier about representation of the Attica prisoners, right? How did you get involved with representation of the Attica prisoners? How did you get involved with that?
Okay. When the Attica Rebellion happened, there were some people that were asked to be observers during the negotiations. This is before the prison was retaken. And a couple of those people were lawyers. William Kunstler was one of the more well-known ones. And he was a member of an organization called the National Lawyers Guild, which I and my office people were members. So when the prison was retaken and all those people were killed and tortured and beaten, a call was put out, a national call by the Lawyers Guild for lawyers to come to New York, upstate New York, to represent the Attica brothers. Firstly, to get a medical attention. Secondly, to stop the brutality that they were still going on and to begin to defend them against what we thought was going to be an attack on really the people who were victimized by Attica and protecting and covering up the killing by the state police and the prison guards who took back Attica on September 13th, 1971, against literally unarmed prisoners and shot them down like dogs in the swamp and beat. And then after they killed 39 prisoners and their own guards who were being held hostage, they then made all the prisoners strip naked, took their glasses, took their false teeth, smashed them in the ground, and then beat them, making them run through gauntlets of guards and state police swinging axes And besides that, 80 other people were shot and didn't get medical care for several days. So lawyers came, and lawyers from my office came, and we began to defend and try to get medical care and treatment for the Attica brothers. Ultimately, they charged 43 prisoners with all kinds of serious felonies, and we had several trials. A lot of people came from non-lawyers to organize, and we had this demand put the governor Rockefeller, who ordered the assault, and put the state on trial, and we wanted them to be indicted, and we had to defend these charges. The charges were dropped against almost all of the brothers. There were several trials, and brothers were found not guilty. And finally, the governor, not Rockefeller, but the next governor, gave a clemency to all the prisoners and took their cases, criminal cases, away.
Okay. How long did the Attica case last?
Well, excellent question. First of all, the criminal cases lasted, started in 71, and the cases were finally dismissed in 1976. But we brought a civil rights suit on behalf of the families of the people who were killed and the people who were tortured. And that case went on for over 25 years.
Wow.
And ultimately, we were able to get, after a lot of back and forth in the courts and everything, we were able to get $12 million for the class of prisoners that had been either they're killed or beaten up or shot. But that took almost 25 years.
That's a long time. I read that that Big Black Smith had received a lump sum for his torture and pain and, you know, the way he treated the brother, right?
Big Black was the leader of the security, who made sure that all the hostages were protected and all the people who came in to help negotiate were protected. And yet they spread a false rumor about that he had castrated a hostage, which was a lie. No one was castrated. So when they retook the prison, they stripped him naked. They put him on a table. They put a football under his chin. And then they put cigars and lit cigarettes out on his body, hot shells. And they said if he dropped that football, they would kill him. And they kept him on that table for 4 hours, torturing him. And ultimately, 25 years later, a jury gave him $4.5 million, which he never got. He only got some small, much smaller amount. But that was what an all-white jury in Buffalo, New York, gave him.
Repeat what did they gave him? What they gave him again?
$4.5 million.
Okay. Could you give us a brief bio of Big Black?
Okay. Big Black was brother from Brooklyn, kind of a street guy. He went to prison. He was a champion football player on the Attica football team, and then he became a coach of the football team. And very well-respected brother, very strong, big brother. And he was chosen to be the head of security, like I said, when the rebellion jumped off. And he took, you know, very seriously, took care of everybody. And then they had that attack when they killed all those people, and he saw people shot down with their arms in the air, surrendering. People under blankets that picked up the blanket and blew their heads off. All kinds of atrocities. And it really changed his whole consciousness. He's talked about this. From that point on, he dedicated his life for the people and for people behind bars, and became a leading spokesperson for the Attica Brothers. And, you know, once he got out of prison, went all over the country speaking about prisons and Attica, and became an unbelievable revolutionary, really, in support of struggle. And Attica was like a crucible that changed his whole consciousness.
Okay. Now I'm reading this book called Guerrilla USA, right? And you speak about the George Jackson Brigade, and it mentioned Big Black as being a member of the George Jackson Brigade.
No. George Jackson Brigade was from the West Coast, like state of Washington, and he was never a member of the George Jackson Brigade. That's wrong. He was a public spokesperson for Attica prisoners until the day he died.
Okay. I understand that you helped put together a documentary called 40 by Attica 40 years later. What exactly does this documentary consist of, and what exactly is the purpose of this documentary?
Well, it really wasn't a documentary. It was a long article we wrote for Prisoner News, which told the story of Attica and then tried to also kind of call the road from Attica. What happened after Attica, you know, with the whole issue of mass incarceration and this whole idea of whether, you know, where the criminal justice system went from Attica, starting to look at the whole, you know, when Attica happened, 72, prison population started to climb and went up consistently for the next 30 years, really. And it was all part of a way to repress the Black liberation movement, beginning with the repression of the Panthers and the riots in the city. Was all a strategy to begin to incarcerate more and more young Black men, and ultimately young Black women as well. And that began as a result in part of Attica, because they saw the consciousness of the prisoners at Attica. There were many politically aware prisoners in prison there, and they realized that they had to begin to lock up more and more people and repress any type of movement that was, you know, starting in terms of liberation.
Okay. I know you mentioned earlier that y'all represented the young lords. What type of cases did the young lords have in regards to pop political cases?
Well, we represented the young lords in Chicago. There was a branch of the young lords that began in New York, which is really more political than the young lords in Chicago. But the young lords in Chicago were dealing with police abuse, harassment. They were trying to control their community, fight gentrification, struggle for good medical care. And also there were members of the young lords that were killed by the police. And we brought cases on their behalf and worked with them in terms of their work in the community. And then subsequent to the young lords, there was people who were more around organizing in the Puerto Rican community in Chicago and New York, and using the issue of Puerto Rican independence. as a way to reach people and to struggle against colonialism, not only in Puerto Rico, but in the cities, particularly Chicago and New York, of how Puerto Ricans are treated. And there was a group that went underground and began to use a series of bombings, and they were called the Fuerzas Armadas Liberación Nacional, or the FALN. And there was a group that there was an investigation, and the grand juries were locking up people from the community trying to find these people. And ultimately, a bunch of them were arrested in 1980 and charged with seditious conspiracy, conspiracy to oppose the authority of Puerto Rico, the U.S. authority in Puerto Rico by force. And they refused to participate in their trials. They said they were prisoners of war, that they had the right to fight against colonialism, and they're not criminals. And they had these series of trials in Chicago, and all of them went to prison. And ultimately, groups of them were given clemency. There was a group of Puerto Ricans who attacked the Congress in 1954, who were Puerto Rican nationalists, Lolita Lebron and Rafael Cancel Miranda and three others. And they went to prison for 25 years, and then Jimmy Carter gave them a clemency, and they went home to Puerto Rico. They were freed. And these new Puerto Ricans from the FALN were in prison for 16 to 19 years, and they were given clemency by Clinton, President Clinton. And just this last few months, Obama gave the last Puerto Rican fighter who was in U.S. prison for 34 years, Oscar Lopez Rivera, cut his sentence. And today, just today, he was released and in public in Puerto Rico. And he's coming to Chicago tomorrow and then going to New York. He's going to be the Grand Marshal of the Puerto Rican Parade, and he's recognized as a hero by the Puerto Rican community.
Okay. I want to ask you a question in regards to, I know it's a lot of political prisoner, right? And I understand that just listening to you and seeing what's going on, it seems to me that it been a lot of focus on releasing the Puerto Rican independent movement prisoners. And there been more of them being released than anybody else. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's a function of the support. First of all, Puerto Rico is a separate nation, right? And it's colonized, but it's separate. They got a separate land base, and they're a separate culture. And they have been able to, the movement in Puerto Rico has been able to organize broad support for their political prisoners. I mean, not just on the left, but religious support, labor union support, and political support from all these different Puerto Rican political parties. And because they've been able to organize such broad support, they put pressure on these public officials, particularly these presidents, to release them. And that's the only way you can get, it's political, and that's what presidents have acceded to this politics. And these other political prisoners, the Black Liberation prisoners or the Leonard Peltier, Native American prisoner, they have support, but the support is not as strong and not as broad as what's been organized in the Puerto Rican movement.
Okay. I understand that. On a new release prisoner, Zola Azania. What type of relationship do you and Zola have?
Well, I was his lawyer. I met Solo when he was 30 days away from a death warrant. He's on death row. He'd been on death row for almost 15 years, and he had been fighting his case and dealing with the, you know, these lawyers that really didn't have their heart in representing him. And I started representing him, and we were able to get the death penalty taken off his case after 15 years of fighting. And just last month, 2 months ago, he was free. So he did 34 years, but he beat the death penalty, and he's back in his community and, you know, rebuilding his life. And throughout the time he was in prison, he's an artist, he's a writer, he's a very political guy, he's very supportive of the Black Liberation Movement, he sees himself as a part of that movement, and he was able to build some support around his case, and we were able to get that death penalty off his back.
Okay.
Thought they went out.
That's a good thing. Okay, you know, I was talking to the brother. He's saying that he's actually pursuing a career in the paralegal field of litigation. You know.
He was a very good lawyer, representing and working on his case when he was in prison, and he's working in terms of trying to, you know, do legal work on his own case and other cases.
True indeed. Now we need more of that, and we need to be able to use these laws and these statutes to benefit the purpose of the people. Because, like you said, this is an unjust system. We've been victims of the unjust for a long time now. And I'd like to ask you another question. What do you identify yourself? Identify yourself as an abolitionist, a revolutionary? You identify yourself as an anarchist? What do you identify yourself as?
Oh, that's a good question. I would say a fighter for justice.
Okay. I know you had told me that you're defending a Panther case. I think you said out of southern Illinois.
Yeah, Carbondale, Illinois. Yeah.
Okay. Can you tell me more about this Carbondale, Illinois chapter?
There was a chapter of the Black Panther Party that was created down in southern Illinois. There's a big university there, Southern Illinois University, Carbondale, Illinois. It's way down south of Illinois. And some of the brothers there started a chapter. They were all living in a house together. One night, the police surrounded the house and started shooting into the house. And the brothers inside returned fire. And there was an actual shootout back and forth in the middle of the night, and it only stopped when members of the Black community of Carbondale came out of their houses and forced the police to stop. And then these members of the community went in and got the people inside to come out, and then were charged with 47 counts of attempt murder. And the trial was in Murfreesboro, Illinois, which is way south, more south than Virginia. And lawyers in my office, including myself, defended them and raised it that they acted in self-defense. And they were acquitted of all charges after a 3-month trial. So that was my first experience, my first jury trial as a lawyer. And the brothers were all able to continue with their political work.
Okay. Yeah, I went on the People's Law Center website, and I seen that you've been involved in a lot of cases. You wrote a lot of different documentation. You go out to your work, and you receive many rewards. You mentioned that you also have represented members of Conscious Citizens of Republic of Africa, as well as the Black Panther Party and the Black Muslim Movement, right? Nation of Islam. What people have you represented for the Republic of Africa besides Zolo?
Well, just in the context of representing people who were in prison, particularly there was a federal prison in Marion. That was when they started the control units, where
yeah.
they big strike and they locked up all these people. And there are a lot of RNA people that were in prison in Marion and BLA people. Akinsiju Ola, I don't know if you know that name. He was in prison in Marion, and then he came out and became he was a writer, and he wrote for several newspapers. And also the Muslim prisoners that I worked with were ones that were in prison, and particularly in Attica, Herbert Eckstein, Akil Aljunde, he's known as. He was Richard X. Clark. These are all Herbert X. These are all Nation of Islam Muslims that were part of the Attica prison rebellion. One of the interesting things is that at Marion, they had a work strike, and they decided that they were going to pick out the leaders and they were going to keep them locked up indefinitely. Usually, if you got in, you were in prison and you did something that they found was a violation of their rule, they'd give you a set time to be in the hole, 30 days, 60 days. But now they decided they wanted to keep these guys locked up indefinitely. So rather than charge them with a specific violation of a rule, they said that they were assigning them administratively to segregation because they posed some kind of threat to the prison, or they were because of the nature of their crime, or because they tried to escape, or because they were writ writers, or because they were political organizers. And they created this indefinite control unit. They called it Marion Prisoners Control Unit. And this unit was replicated all over the country by state prison systems. Each state wanted to have their own control unit so they could lock up, you know, the politically active prisoners. And, of course, you know about Pelican Bay in California and in Illinois. We had a thing called TAMS, and these were all units locked up, control units that locked up prisoners. And we fought that, and we had some rulings and bad rulings, and the prison law became bad. You know, at first after Attica, there was idea of we're going to reform prisons, we're going to make them more humane, and we'll give some money. But then really most of the money after Attica went to more prison guards, more walls, more private prisons, more security, and this is where the whole prison industrial complex took off.
Okay. Let me ask you another question. Do you think the prison system can be reformed?
No.
Okay.
As long as we have the type of economic system and the type of, you know, neglect of communities, you got to start with the community. You got to start with, you know, changing the economic system so it's fair and there's more opportunity, and stop, you know, warehousing poor people and people of color. And it cannot really be reformed.
Okay. Is the People Law Office currently engaged, or have they did in the past, did in community workshop for the people so people can learn certain laws and certain concepts that they can work for the benefit of the people?
Yeah, we worked a lot through this organization I mentioned, the National Lawyers Guild, which has a chapter in big cities, and we deal with training lawyers how to represent victims of police brutality, how to sue for wrongful convictions, and how to fight for you know, for justice in terms of representing activists who are you know, locked unfairly repressed by the government, people who are protesting. We represent a lot of people who are arrested for political protest and different struggles in the city, and we do a lot of know your rights training so that people know what they can do and can't do on the street.
Okay. If a person wanted to get involved with some of these programs, the workshop, how would an individual go about getting involved with it, be a participant?
Well, I would contact the National Lawyers Guild in the city that they're in. If they're in Chicago, there's a number they can call in Chicago. If they're in New York, Washington, D.C., wherever city they are, they should contact them and say, I want to get involved. How can I get involved in, you know, these issues around political issues?
Okay. Okay. It's a march going on in August in D.C. in regard to the Me from Prison Human Rights March. Where they challenge the 13, where they challenge the 13th Amendment and the aspect of modern prison being modern day slavery. Are you aware of that? Are you aware of the event taking place?
No, I'm not aware of it. No, I would like to know about it.
Okay. What actually are your thoughts in regard to the 13th Amendment? No, what are your thoughts about that? As you being a lawyer. You know what I'm saying? You've been in the litigation field, you've been, you know the legal system. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that imprisoning people who, because of their economic or, you know, race or nationality or is a form of a violation of the 13th Amendment. And the 13th Amendment was supposedly to do away with all forms of slavery, and we're still, you know, now we've, as Michelle Alexander pointed out in her book, we now have a new Jim Crow, which is locking up people using their race or their poverty as a way to warehouse them and incarcerate them.
If the 13th Amendment become eradicated or removed, you think the prison system still exists?
I mean, you know, my belief is that the prison system will exist until there's a change in the society in terms of how we deal with each other and with our communities. Until we have equality and still we have real democracy, they're going to need to lock up people because that's a form of control, and they're going to want to control, you know, people. That's how they stay in power.
Okay. I want to ask another question. When you represent a political prisoner, somebody behind the wall, or represent anybody in general, when you go to the state, how do the people of the state treat you, knowing that you work for the People Law Office?
Well, you know, in some instances they're hostile. In some instances they try to be friendly, but their interests are against yours. The judges are not always friendly, but you have to just fight on, you know. You're representing people who, you know, are in many cases opposed to the system, and in many cases are speaking out or acting out against the system, and therefore, you know, they're unpopular, and you're representing them, so you become unpopular too. It's part of the job, though.
True indeed, okay. When you hear the name George Jackson, What does that name mean to you when you hear the name George Lester Jackson? Saw Larry Brother Blood. I mean, what does that name mean to you?
Well, it means that it makes me think of a great revolutionary who was one of the inspirations for the Attica Rebellion, for one, who's, you know, written some very intense and important books, a note, you know, Letters and Blood in My Eye, and who was assassinated by the prison officials in San Quentin. So it makes me think about resistance and struggle.
True indeed, true indeed. True indeed. Who are some of your inspirations in regards to the Puerto Rican independent movement, the Black Liberation Movement, the African independent movement? Who are some of your inspirations, the people that inspire you, motivate you?
One person that greatly inspired me was Rafael Cancel Miranda, who was a Puerto Rican nationalist prisoner who was at Marion, who I met in 1971, and a great revolutionary. He's got out of prison in 79. He's been a spokesperson for the independence movement in Puerto Rico. Another person that inspires me is a Mexican fighter from Colorado named Ricardo Romero, who was organizing Chicano Mexican prisoners throughout the Southwest, and was one of the people that I represented in fighting the grand jury when they were trying to investigate resistance movements in the Southwest and in all through the U.S. William Kunstler, who was a great lawyer, inspired me as a lawyer to fight for justice. Sundiata Coley, who's still in prison, a BLA guy who I met at Marion, inspired me. Of course, Big Black was my inspiration, the Attica brother. Those are some of the people that's inspired me.
Oh, okay. Got another question for you. In Attica, what exactly movements were involved in the rebellion? Because, you know, you hear about, people like Big Black, you know, you hear names like that, but what actually movements were involved in the whole rebellion, to your understanding?
Well, there was the Nation of Islam. There was also a group which was a spinoff called the Five Percenters, which was a group in the New York prison system. I don't think it was outside the prison system. There was
it was 5% outside, because it started from Temple Number 7-8 up on the Malcolm X. It was on the street.
Okay. There was Panthers, people who identify with the Panther, Black Panther Party. There was, as I said, Young Lords. Those were the main groups. And there were some white revolutionaries, a couple of people, a guy by the name of Sam Melville, who had gone to prison for some bombings. And there were some people who were around him in the prison. So there was different, and there were other people who had been involved in the civil rights movement and went to prison, who were not affiliated with any specific group, but were politically developed and aware of what was going on.
Okay. I like the sound of that. Let's say that. From your lawyer experience, how many cases have How many cases have you fought that last a long time, that take you a long time to win? Basically, I'm asking, what is your longest case that you don't fought?
Well, Attica was the longest one because the civil case went for so long. I've had other cases that have gone on for, you know, several years. I've represented Palestinian Americans who have been accused of being, involved with supporting terrorism, and some were arrested in Palestine and tortured by the Israelis, and then charged in the U.S. And that case went on for 3 or 4 years. And the Marion struggle around the prisons went on for many years. I also was involved in representing the Pontiac brothers. They were prisoners in a prison in Illinois, and there was a rebellion, and three guards were killed, and they charged 17 young black men with the death penalty in Illinois. And we got the case moved to Chicago, and ultimately all of them were either acquitted or their charges were dropped, and no one was convicted of anything as a result of that rebellion.
Okay.
That case went on for several years.
Okay, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because we actually had Ike Taylor on the show a couple months ago. He was speaking about the Pontiac brothers. Now, he was speaking about that case because he was a part of the Pontiac 17. They were speaking about it, right?
Yeah.
You know, and
yeah,
that was a very interesting case because that case represents, to me, it represents the aspect of a unification, because you had many brothers from different types of street holdings and street institutions that came together for the benefit of uniting themselves, trying to free and liberate themselves, you know. So that actually was a good thing. It showed you that we can put aside our differences and stand on a purpose and goal and agenda. Just like the same thing that was established when the Republican Republic was still established. Different people from different ideologies came along to identify with independence and land. You know, liberation that we want. You know what I'm saying? My next question is, how exactly did you get involved with Representative Leonard Peltier?
Well, through the prison, Leonard Peltier was at Marion Prison. And there was a work stoppage, and there was a group of lawyers that were helping the prisoners who were down in Southern Illinois, and they formed a thing called the Marion Prisoner Rights Project. And the prison barred them from going into the prison. And so we brought a lawsuit, and Leonard was one of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit. The other plaintiff was Sundiata Kohli and one other person. And so we developed a relationship with Leonard. And, you know, Leonard now is in prison in Florida, and he's not getting medical care, and he's not in good physical health, and he's been in all these years. And Obama refused to give him a pardon or clemency. And, of course, we know that he won't get it from Trump. So, you know, Leonard is suffering, and, you know, we should be able to support him in terms of his case.
Okay. Okay. In regard to Sundiata or Kohli, What type of individual is he when you met him? What can you tell me about his character?
Well, he's an incredible person. Very intelligent, very soft-spoken, very well-read, very solid person. And, of course, he's another person that is getting screwed around by the parole board, you know? They they won't let him go home, and there's no reason why he shouldn't be free except, you know, political vengeance, you know, politically motivated. So I would say him and Leonard are two of the most important political prisoners. Also, Herman Bell and Jaleel
Moulton King.
Those are all people that have been in too long, and it's time that they should be free.
You also got Rochelle McGee.
Absolutely. Rochelle McGee's another person that should be free.
True indeed, brother. I'd like to thank you for coming on to this show and being a part of our broadcast and share your knowledge with understanding the people, you know, and continue your working legacy as a representative of the people, People Law Center, a representation of the people, and continue to fight this oppression and continue to educate the people and the masses in regard to law that work for us, right? Work for us as a people, because we need to know how we can utilize this system for our benefit, for the benefits of liberation. Because the way I look at it, long as the system exists, we can continue to be in this physical as well as the mental bondage. A lot of people look at themselves being free because they're outside on the streets. But you know, you look at it realistically, there's nothing in the world that's free. They call things a free world. There's nothing in the world free. Everything has some kind of cost, some kind of payment to it. So you're looking at certain things, certain aspects of it. A lot of us are victimized on the street due to the fact that we're uneducated. What exactly going on? And a lot of us are afraid to fight, because we are comfortable with what the system does, or the way the system makes us feel, the gratification of the system, and what it does, you know, and we're dependent upon it. And that it make a lot of afraid to be independent, afraid to do for themselves, to do for ourselves, you know. It's very interesting, you know. It's just about looking at it from different levels of it, the different perspectives and the histories and the events that have been taking place, especially in regards to all the political brutality that's been going on the last 3-4 years, where people just been killed systematically, like it's a program, you know. You know what I'm saying? Without even being armed, or without even being a threat to the oppressor. I want to thank you for coming on to the show. We're about to let the callers ask some questions, make some statements. I'm gonna do you peace, bro.
Okay. If anyone has a question or comment, all lines are open at this time. So if anyone has a question or comment, feel free. Go ahead, brother.
Well, this is Brother Sky right here, man.
How you doing,
man? I send my respects to all y'all, man. You know I love y'all, man. Hey, but the thing is that I was listening, you know, and I've been following that historical movement for the last probably 30-something years. And I mean, you were so accurate in all your assessments. All I really want to say is that, man, I commend brothers and sisters like yourself who literally take on, you know, these challenges, man, and fight back against the system legally, as well as, you know, get out in the street and protest on a grassroots level. Because I think the American people don't understand that these institutions that they build, where they lock people up indefinitely, is for them. They literally build these institutions for locking Americans up. So if you claiming to be American, you just one mistake away from being held in a torture chamber. And that's how everybody that lives under this here government should be looking at these institutions. They not good. They don't do no good for this society as a whole. They're a threat to everybody as a whole. They destroy families. And I noticed, like, a lot of these new, they got a new thing going on where everybody have to be a part of this, like, self-help system. And the self-help program deals with where if you want to go home, you got to take, you got to pay for these courses to go home, and you got to take all these self-help for anger management. Whether you got any these issues, NAAA, and they good, but the whole problem, once you get inside of doing them, you start to see they orientating and indoctrinating you to a capitalist way of thinking. And a lot of people who have these socialist understandings as to how the people in the world should be evolving, or ideologies, I should say, these things is counterproductive for our way of life. And I was just sitting up here thinking when you was talking about, you know, all the different reasons and struggles and consequences and et cetera, is why people, like when he brought up his brother Petier, I mean, this brother would have countless support, like Mumia, countless support. And this system and this arrogant stance still don't respect their humanity and realize their circumstances was dictated by a government that was accepting this banking, which every person in this country that claimed to be whatever should have been rebelling against. So, you know, if it wasn't for grassroots organizations like yours and others, I mean, we wouldn't have a chance whatsoever, man. So I commend you for coming on the show, and I commend you for all the great work y'all do in the courtrooms and outside the courtroom, because we wouldn't be nothing. And I come up out of the Pelican Bay recent hunger strike movement, prison human rights movement, and I understand how important people like yourself is inside those struggles. So I commend you, bro. And one love, one struggle, man. All power to the people.
Thank you.
Okay, call from a 614 area code. Are you on?
Yes, I'm here.
All right, Mama Conley,
welcome. I love cool, the way you like to put me on Front Street. How you doing?
I'm all right.
How you doing, Brother Bomani?
I'm doing well, so sorry about yourself.
I do.
Good to hear your voice, sister.
Thank you. It's good to be heard. To our guests, good evening, and thank you for being here. I am an unofficial co-host of George Jackson University Radio. My name, or I'm affectionately known as Mama Condi. And
nice to meet you.
Thank you. I would like to thank you. Brother Zolo and I have been communicating for double digits of years. And he speaks well of you, very well. For me, you stand on his credit. And that's a key thing. What you do is enormous, because I've helped a lot of the people you've named with cases and just being supportive and building support for them and with them. And it's more than a notion. I know way more about the law now than I ever wanted to know. And it's a labor of love, but it's a labor, mouth's not working tonight. It's a labor of target practice. And when you work with brothers and sisters behind the walls, you become the target. And the system is practicing on you. So I hold you in high esteem with other attorneys who have dedicated themselves to assisting. Did you actually get to work with William Kunstler?
I did. Yes, I did. I was at some point worked in the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York. William Kunstler was one of the founders, and we did several cases together, and I was knew him well, yes.
Excellent. I was attacked by the state of Ohio, and there is an attorney here who I call affectionately Ohio's version of William Kunstler. His name is J. Tullis Rogers. He helped me with my case when the state attacked me. And he's also the attorney who brought, what's it when you can get free representation? What's that called again?
Gideon versus Wainwright or public defender or
public defender. He did that for the state of Ohio so that folks here who could not afford an attorney would have representation. And that's why I call him that. And he was familiar with a lot of the cases with the Black Panthers. You know, out here it's like people are lulled to sleep. And so getting support out here is a real, real burden. And when they come after you because of your activism, because of the work that we do for our people, the propaganda is so strong that people who were kinfolk to me would question me if what the system was saying I did was true. I'm like, you're in my house every day. You know it ain't true. But anytime they can build that kind of propaganda and media, you know, debauchery of one's character, it's a nightmare, and I can't thank you enough for what y'all do. I thank you.
Thank you.
I relinquish the mic.
All right. Okay, all lines are open. So if anyone else has a question or comment, we have about 50 minutes left in the show. So any additional questions or comment, please feel free.
Okay, since nobody's saying anything, I'll say some more. This is Mama Condi again. And Zolo and I have been reconnected thanks to George Jackson University and y'all's collective effort to get him out 3 months ago. What was the final piece in the case that was able to free him?
Well, the key piece in the case was actually discovered by Zolo himself when there was a small article in the Fort Wayne newspaper. That's where he got his death penalty. That there was a problem with the jury system, and they had to reformulate it. And it turns out that almost the entire black population of Wayne County, where Fort Wayne, Indiana is, was excluded from the computer system when they were selecting jurors. so that he had an all-white jury, and the group that they drew from underrepresented black people by 75%. So we were, even though we couldn't convince the judge that that was a problem, we convinced the Indiana Supreme Court, and they ordered him to have another death penalty trial. And from there, we were able to delay and create other issues. And then it turned out that there was a judge that said, you waited too long. You cannot give him a death penalty trial. It's too long after the incident, because by now, almost 25 years had gone by. So they appealed to the Indiana Supreme Court again and won, and we were back waiting for a trial, and that's when we were able to negotiate a resolution that took the death penalty off, and he had to do an additional 7 years in prison, but he's home now. So they did, and he was like number one on the list that they wanted to execute. They definitely wanted to execute Zolo, and now he's free. So that's a big victory for everyone.
He's an awfully creative film, too. I mean, he sews by hand. You know, he knows how to use a sewing machine, but he sews by hand. And you name it, he can sew it. I had an aunt like that. She'd make coats by hand.
Yeah.
And I was just impressed with him for that. And like Sundi Adakole, he's also a painter. And
very good work.
And his writings are just very, Does the George Jackson University have any of Baba Zolo's writings in their library, Bomani or Ajanaku?
Not to my knowledge, not that I know of. But we can add some, though. We can definitely do that.
Please do that. That would be beautiful. And to the attorney, can you say your name again for me, please?
Michael Deutsch.
Spell your last name.
D-E-U-T-S-C-H.
Oh, I remember seeing your name. I'm blind now. Everything, you know, I try to connect the dots using my imagination and my memory. And actually, my imagination is a little stronger than my memory. But I do remember your name. I remember seeing your name.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pleasure to finally get to speak with you. I worked with Ruchel McGee. You mentioned him. I worked with him in some small portion with his case back when Mandela was still incarcerated. And the most interesting thing about that was that, or I don't know if that's true now, but it was at that time, that Ruchel had been incarcerated longer than Nelson, and the word was that Nelson had been the longest incarcerated. But the research we did showed Ruchel to be the longest incarcerated. Who does that honor fall on now, this year, this day?
It's the BLA people, Herman Bell and Sundi Adakole and Jalil and Leonard Peltier. Those are the people that I think have been incarcerated the longest, that group of people.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there are others that, you know, I'm not remembering, but those are the ones that are most well known.
Sundiata and Mumia and I go that.
Yeah.
Mumia and I, we grew up together. We were in the Black Panther Party together. We were Moose supporters together, and we went to the same broadcast school. And Sundiata, I have co-founded several independent African schools, and I gave an assignment to my class to write to political prisons. So some of the students wrote to Ruchel, some of them wrote to Mutulu, some of them wrote to Mumia, some of them wrote to Sundiata, some of them wrote to Sekou Kambui, Baba Tanu, he just passed. And so there was this long list. And one of the students asked Baba Sundiata Akoli if he knew me. And it took Baba a while to write back. But when he did, he said, I'd have to lose all my brain cells to forget Mama Kandi, which was just kind of, that was one of those things that bring tears to your eyes. And let you know that the work you do is meaningful. And being supportive of brothers and sisters behind the walls is, I think, one of the most, what's the word? Is there a word for it that we can do? I attended the MOVE conference 2 weekends ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very beautifully structured. They had an itinerary that had different MOVE members from the prison calling and being able to address the audience. It was at a school on Tasker Street, 33rd and Tasker. I forget the name of the school. But it was a beautiful facility, and they had everything, you know, in place. Brother Kamal did the videoing, so the next day you could get the previous day's video. They had MOVE members come up and speak, MOVE supporters come up and speak, and talk about what happened from 77 in Rochester to the present day. It was an absolutely beautiful thing. I had forgotten how short Ramona and Pam are. And we just cried and hugged each other. You know, it was like old home week. And everybody told their story about, you know, what had happened and their portion in it. And they invited me to tell mine. Mine began before Rochester and ended pretty much when the cops came in and trampled me and my daughters and beat me into miscarriage for being a spokesperson for MOVE. So it was the first time I had ever told that part of the story. I also was the videographer when the Provisional Government Republic of New Africa videoed the community's own hearing. And I also kept a record of the hearings that were done by the city. I've got a lot of the paperwork. And I just had a chance to reunite, and prayerfully we'll be able to get some people to help us update the materials that I have so I can turn it over to them and, you know, let them house it for a while. I relinquish the mic.
So we have a caller from a 610 error code. Do you have a question or comment for our guest?
Yes, hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, we got you. We can hear you.
Hi, my name is Jordan Winquist. I'm a National Lawyers Guild member out here in Philadelphia. Hi, Michael. Yeah, I had a question. Well, I was also at the Mood Conference, as the woman was just saying. It was a very powerful conference with political prisoners and the community. It was a good time, and I like to see that. I like to see that in the political prisoner work, lawyers, community members, and political prisoners all kind of coming together in solidarity with Bennett for the long haul, like yourself, Mrs. Deutsch. My question is, well, first of all, I want to point out that in Philadelphia last night, a district attorney was elected who is pretty progressive. I don't know if he's a radical or a liberal, but he's someone who's advocated on behalf of the community for a long time. So it was a big kind of special win for us, where this person is going to attack the system of mass incarceration, and he's represented all types of political activists over the decades. I feel like what got him there was this kind of long trajectory of being a community lawyer and working out of sort of a collective atmosphere, where he had a renowned community activist who was his office manager. He had someone working as a bag man who did kind of publicity and media. And so I feel like I'm not saying becoming a district attorney is the end-all goal, but I think he's a pretty powerful institution, and they are a pretty powerful institution in Philadelphia, both the legal collective and the gentleman, Larry Krasner. Now, my question relates to the People's Law Office. Is the model of, like, this law collective, is that kind of the best way forward? I know there were a lot more during the 80s, but I think that would be an ideal scenario where you have community activists working alongside lawyers, all working on common causes, using our different strengths. I think that would be kind of the ideal setup, where you have lawyers and the community working day to day on a daily basis with each other, kind of driving things forward. My follow-up question to that is, you mentioned that the system can't be reformed. So what avenues or ideas do you suggest to kind of, like, apply pressure? I know that's kind of a monster question, but any other thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I don't really have any great answers I think you're right that the more closer you work with communities and you integrate them into your strategy and into your work, the more effective it's going to be. And, you know, we work a lot with different communities around the cases. And, of course, there's political cases and there's community support. We'll work with the community leaders, meet with them, we'll respect their ideas and work with trying to implement their ideas. So I think we just need to begin to, you know, work together and have strategies that bring more people, educate more people, and bring more people into the struggle.
To the caller, what is your name again?
Yeah, my name is Jordan Winquist. I'm a lawyer here in Philadelphia. I think I met you briefly through Kilo.
Did you see an elder mama in a wheelchair? I'm the only elder female that was in a wheelchair the whole weekend.
Yes, I believe I was introduced to you by the two people from Texas.
Oh, that was you. Okay. Thank you.
And Michael, Brad Thompson was out there, and I was really glad to see him out there. He's someone from the People's Law Office, a legal worker for 10 years,
right,
doing political center advocacy. So I appreciate him coming out, and I'd like to continue working with him.
Good. That's great. Very important.
Okay, we have a caller from the 213 area code. They have a question. Go ahead with your question or comment.
Yes. Can y'all hear me?
Yes.
Yes. I was tuning in. Got in kind of late. I was tuning in the past maybe 15, 20 minutes. And I have a question about the brother Zulu. Was he exonerated, or was he compensated for the time he did, or was he just released as part of a plea deal he received?
He was not exonerated. He was released, first taken off a death row, and then released as part of some kind of settlement resolution. Yeah, he was not found to be not exonerated.
Okay.
One
more question. Where is he at today? And what is he doing? You know, how can he be reached or anything like that?
He lives in Gary. Yeah, but these people know how to reach him, right?
We had him on his show last week, so you can contact us. We can give you he has a web address, but you can listen to the broadcast last week where he had him. He talked about his GoFundMe page, and he has a website that, you know, the link to his artwork and the email. So you can just contact us after the broadcast closes, and we can put you in contact with the brother.
Okay.
What's your name again?
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. My name is Bless Shakur.
Bless Shakur. Tell us about you.
I'm a host at a radio station out of New Mexico called Radius Radio. I host a show there every Thursday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And I'm an author of a book titled Live to Tell, which is on at my website, which is lifestorypublications.com. It also can be found at on Barnes & Noble, Amazon, and it also can be found on Matula Shakur's website, where his book's at, is also there as well.
Okay, you were asking about communicating with Zolo, and that's why I asked something about you.
Right. Yeah. I'm a community activist. I'm working with the sister. Her name is Queen. She go by the name Queen Mother Afia. She has a Malcolm X festival coming up this Saturday, actually. And I'm working with her, putting the festival together and everything. I just speak with the sister earlier, and we're trying to, get this festival going. She was doing it for the past 19 years, and this year I'm actually participating and helping her organize that.
Okay.
I have a question for the law attorneys. How does somebody go about getting selected for jury duty? I mean, I used to get them in the mail years ago, but it's been like at least a good 10 years since I've been asked for jury duty.
Each state does it a little bit differently, but usually they use voter rolls, and then they supplement the voter rolls with your, motor vehicle registration or your electric bill, and it's supposed to represent, a fair cross section of the community, and you're supposed to, you may not get called, but if you look at it, it's supposed to. The numbers in the jury selection supposed to represent pretty much the numbers of representation of the different races in the community, So
okay.
Sometimes they don't keep it up to date, and sometimes it runs in a way that excludes people, and you should always make sure that someone's checking how the jury system is operating.
Okay, I mean, is there a way that you can go and, put your name in to be called or make sure that you're on the list or anything like that?
Well, it depends. It depends. I don't know there's any way you could say I want to be on the list. But if you found out that the state that you're in uses just voter lists, then that's not a problem. If it's supplementing the voter list with other lists, then you could check and see if your name's in the list, I guess. You'd have to talk to the clerk and see if that's possible.
Okay, the clerk of the court?
Yeah, clerk of the court, where the jury selection is held there.
All right, thank you. Okay, so we're coming down to the last 30 minutes of the show. So I see that we have a new caller. You have a call from the 919 area code. Any questions or comments?
Yes, revolutionary greetings and solidarity.
Greetings,
can you hear me pretty good?
Yes, we can hear you, brother.
All right, then, that's what's up. That's what's up. Greetings to the panel of VJU. I only got a few questions, right? I'm just not kind of hopping on right now. So I just wanted to ask, first of all, thank you for coming on to the GJU radio program. I'm sure that this conversation has been very enlightening. I hate having missed a large part of it. I'm going to be kind of quick and straight to the point. One, I just had two questions.
Free the land, brother.
Hey, free the land, brother, comrade. The very first question I wanted to ask is basically relating to the 13th Amendment, United States Constitution, you know, the exception clause that is there. Right now they have this convention that's going around where I think a few states are attempting to amend the Constitution. And I'm hearing it's like a lot of Republicans, particularly conservatives, coming from a very racist element within that conservative circle. My question is, do you know much about that as far as, like, is it like a runaway convention where anyone can usually, like, bring amendments to the table from any, you know, from any angle, or is they usually, like, just strictly limited to the people that are trying to amend it and kind of just limited to their issues? Because right now you have different states that's passing, you know, that's passing it right along, and these states are building up, you know, in agreement to amend the Constitution. I understand they only need just a few states to actually do it.
No, they need 2/3 of the state legislatures to amend the federal Constitution. I don't see that as really something that's going to happen, but I'm not that familiar with that movement, so I don't feel capable of really speaking on the strategy of the movement or, you know, what they're trying to accomplish with that. I guess what they're trying to say is this, you know, legalizing imprisonment is kind of put in the 13th Amendment, and they want that out of there because then, you know, that would show that...
Pardon me one second. I didn't mean to cut you. No, that wasn't kind of what I was talking about. Maybe I should have put the 13th in the beginning. What I was saying was right now, there is a convention that's going around right now where you have different states that are requesting for amendments, and it's mostly being done by groups like ALEC and some other, like I say, racist elements. They're trying to, you know what I'm saying, control how they're, how the budget is, how the budget is done inside the country, and some other rules they're trying to shift around that is being restricted or blocked by the Constitution. They've already built up a number of states already, because you know it's two ways you can get the Constitution amended. But this particular way they're going about it, states are actually voting, and the states are actually approving. So it's kind of rolling, you know. I mean, it's more and more states that are actually getting on board with amending this the way they want it amended. And maybe you're not familiar with it, so I won't kind of burden you with that question right there. But that's kind of where I was at just now with it. As far as the 13th, I didn't hear you.
No, I said I understand. I get it now.
Okay. As far as the 13th Amendment is concerned, that is a whole nother ball game right there, and that's something that the prison movement and people outside the prison movement are actually working on, because that's going to take a breath along as far as it relates to public education. Agitation and mobilizing, and I'm really just trying to move the pressure, because right now it is a violation of the United Nations Human Rights Charter and a bunch of other things as well. We do know modern-day slavery is taking place inside this country in the penal systems, as well as we know prisoners are commodities. The point is when are the people going to stand up to do something about that and change that inside this country. But with that said, my next question I wanted to ask was that, is it related to when you was representing a lot of the political prisoners that was on the front getting caught up or set up based on Cointel and Cointel Pro information? Was you as an attorney, was you personally harassed on any level? You know, like personally, did you notice anything that was standing out? And if so, how did you usually take those attacks?
Well, there was a certain amount of harassment. Our office was spied upon. I was accused of being involved in, I mean, never charged, but being involved in assisting an escape. My fingerprints, they said, were found in a safe house, which was all lies. So there is a certain amount of pressure and harassment that sometimes the lawyers get, nothing like what happens to the people who are on the front lines. But like I said before, that comes with the territory.
And that about answers my question. That once again, I appreciate it. And one thing I always say is we definitely appreciate any and all attorneys, attorneys of the people, that are fighting for the people's cause. We always appreciate the service that you put in with serving the people. And with that said, I just say all power to the people.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, all lines are still open. We wind it down to about the last 20 minutes of the show. So any questions or comments, please feel free.
Do you have any idea what's happening with Munta Kim's case and with Amin's case?
No, I don't. I'm not familiar with those cases.
Okay, so as we wind down, I would just like to personally thank the guest for all his hard work that he's doing on behalf of the people. You know, I really admire someone who can take on the system, and it speaks volumes about you as a person. If you can take on a corrupt system and get people like Brother Zolo free, that means you're an exceptional, outstanding lawyer. You could easily be one of those lawyers, like a $300, $400 an hour attorney, and instead you choose to use your energy and your, you know, your capabilities for the people. So that just speaks volumes of the type of person you are. So I really commend you on the work you're doing, and I really thank you for taking time out your busy schedule to appear on our broadcast. So with that being said, no problem at all. I really admire what you're doing.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for having me, and good luck with your program, and hope to have in touch with you again sometime.
Definitely. So with that being said, I would like to just get a closing comment from my co-host, Brother Bomani Shakur, as well as a closing comment from our other co-host, Sister Mama Kandi. And then we can wrap
up. Okay. Okay. All thing I want to say, you know, that I appreciate all y'all brothers and sisters who are contributing any kind of contributing any kind of work and effort toward our liberation struggle. It could be legal, it could be writing brothers, it could be sending money out, it could be community organizing, wherever it may be. I salute all y'all brothers and sisters and y'all continued efforts in our struggle for liberation and independence. And if you have anybody who's incarcerated or victim of incarceration, please look into our website with www.judgejudson.com to get politically educated. Try to find the community, establish study groups, educate the mind and master the people. Begin a book club if possible. And it's called Education Liberation. I want to say free all the political prison and free all the victims of mass incarceration. Free the land.
I have a final question. Does your organization initiate or sponsor or help regular people format study groups whose focus is the law?
What I said before is the National Lawyers Guild does do work with community groups, training on Know Your Rights and Freedom of Information Act and those kinds of things. So if you're in a certain area, you, try to contact the Lawyers Guild chapter in your area.
The Lawyers chapter, do they deal with things like Indigenous Peoples Law, UCC code, international law? Do they include those kinds of things as well?
So in some places they have those things. It depends upon the work of the local chapters.
Thank you for your patience and your time and your willingness to inform us here at George Jackson University. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Well, that's just been another informative and wonderful show. I once again thank our guests for appearing on the show. I thank everyone who called in with a question or comment. And I thank everyone out in the listening audience. Tune in next Tuesday at 8 o'clock, 7 o'clock Central Standard Time for another edition of George Jackson University Radio. Thank you.
Tuesday?
Good night.
Tuesday?
I'm sorry,
Tuesday?
Wednesday.
Wednesday, come right. Next Wednesday.
Right, Wednesday. My day is mixed up. But Wednesday, 8 o'clock Eastern Time, 7 o'clock Central Standard Time. Thank you.
Okay,
and good evening.
We got your back.
All right, I appreciate it.
Appreciate it, Conrad. I appreciate it, Michael.